Hi everyone, good evening. Let's get this show on the road. Thank you all for coming. It's so good to see such a great turnout for this really important discussion, Russia's war on Ukraine in 2024. What do we expect? Are we at a situation of impasse? And is this really a pivotal moment for Ukraine's war of national liberation? My name's Luke Cooper. I work at LSE Ideas, the think tank here at the LSE. We've been engaging the question and topic of Ukraine in different ways over the last couple of years. One way is as with the Peace and Conflict Resolution Evidence Platform, Ukraine team, where we work with colleagues and civil society in country inside Ukraine to produce evidence-based research that supports in one way or another Ukraine's territorial integrity and political democracy. So it's a great honour to be chairing this discussion tonight. We've got a wonderful panel that are going to talk us through these issues. It is going to be a very participatory format, and we're really keen to have your comments, questions and discussions later on too. So without further ado, I'll introduce our panel. In furthest away from me, on my right-hand side, is Maria Zolkina. She's a DNAM Research Fellow in the Department of International Relations at the LSE that has organised tonight's event. She's a Ukrainian researcher and political analyst working in the fields of regional security, reintegration policies in occupied territories. She did a great recent event on this, I've heard. I wasn't able to make it, unfortunately. But doing really great work in pushing the question of Ukraine and its political future and its European destiny out into the LSE intellectual community, as you can see tonight. We're also joined by Olga Tukaruk from Chatham House. Olga is a OSUN Academy Fellow with the Ukraine Forum at Chatham House. Her main professional interests are international affairs and research on disinformation, so we'll be asking her about that later on, and particularly disinformation and hybrid warfare in the context of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. She was previously a journalist at Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism at the University of Oxford and various other well-qualified background and expertise to offer her thoughts tonight. Lastly, nearest to me, we have Marina Vorotnyuk, is an associate fellow at the Royal United Services Institute for Defence and Security Studies in London. She previously held the position as research fellow in the International Security Studies team at RUSI. So for those on Twitter, and we do encourage you to promote tonight's event to the LSE community, and please, when you do so, use the term hashtag LSEIR. So, right, without further ado, let's get this show on the road. So, Maria, let's go to you first. How is the situation on the battlefield? How does the military balance of forces currently interact with the diplomatic field? Where do you see things?
Thank you, Luke. Is it working? I hope so. Yes. The situation on the battlefield looks like the combination of number of factors. First of all, it's absolutely obvious that Ukraine is not getting all needed support, and the main problem is the political turbulence in US, which you are absolutely aware of. But on the other hand, this pushes other Ukrainian partners, namely European Union member states and European Union as an international actor, to proceed and to advance with their reaction to the lack of support to Ukraine from the main military donor. In particular, some specific initiatives have been launched, like from Czech Republic, and this is kind of a response to the lack of ammunition and lack of weapons on the battlefield, on the ground. The Avdiivka occupation, which happened recently, and actually devastation of the city, destruction of the city, was a direct result on the battlefield of the lack of armor, of the lack of weapons, and which prevented Ukraine from keeping the control over the city. And this is not just the end in this story. The main strategy of two parties, I mean Ukraine and Russia on the battlefield as of now, looks like as following. On the one hand, Ukraine is actually forced just to try to defend rather than attack or offend anywhere, exactly because of lack of new forces or on the one hand, or ammunition on the other hand, and weapons. But Russia is using its regular military tactics, which is indoctrinated everywhere in Russian military, in Russian legislation on how to wage the war. Basically, they are using this moment of the weakness of Ukraine and lack of weapons and ammunition in order to organize a breakthrough. And when I hear a lot in UK and somewhere else recently that the worst case scenario for Ukraine is that Ukraine is not regaining control over any new territories which are occupied by Russia in 2024, I just doubt that this is the worst case scenario. The worst case scenario is that Ukraine does not possess capacities and capabilities to prevent Russian serious breakthrough or another large scale attacks. For this reason, we have been witnessing, for instance, beginning, it actually started several months ago, but it started pretty recently, of serious fortifications, not just along the already existing front line on the continental part of the warfare domain, but along entire line of Ukraine and Russian border, exactly for the reason that Ukraine is preparing just in case for another large-scale attack, which might happen somewhere far away from already existing frontline area, namely Kharkiv, Sumy region are still under under the risk. Ukraine cannot just release the forces and military units which are concentrated along Ukraine and Belarus border in order to make them help those who are on a more active frontline areas close to the south and east of Ukraine, exactly for the reason because you simply cannot create any gaps in your defense lines, even if there are no active warfare there yet, and even if the possibility of invasion or attacks on the side of the north of Ukraine, like from Belarus territory, is not as high as, for instance, attempts of Russia to organize a breakthrough from already occupied territories in south and in the east. So everything will depend in 2024 on whether Ukraine will be able to fulfill two tasks. First and foremost, the most important actually is to break this taboo or problems in different countries, it looks differently, on supplying Ukraine the needed types of weapons in the needed quantities. Why I'm speaking here not generally about military aid, but about specific military weapons or equipment. Let's take Crimea as an example. So when we're thinking about Crimea and regaining control over the south, or Crimea in particular, everyone is basically imagining the situation when Ukraine organizes the land operations invading the peninsula. And this seems like a disaster crossing, as people used to say, many political red lines for Putin, and this will lead, as some argue, to some kind of disaster scenario like using the nuclear weapons on the side of Russia. But on the other hand, this is unlikely that Ukraine will be using just classical conventional tactics when it comes to regaining control over all the occupied territories, including Crimea. In order to prevail while and regain the control over those territories, you need highly technological weapons, you need longer range missiles, which Ukraine is not receiving, namely ATACMS of a specific specific types. And on the other hand, even those weapons like longer range missiles Ukraine is getting from France and UK, they are not in needed quantities, and that's why every time you have many targets which are very attractive in terms of to destruct the Russian military bases, stockpiles in the very deep heartland of occupied territories, you have to decide basically. And this is the task number one, to change the logic when it comes to specific types of the weapons which are not being sent to Ukraine yet on the one hand, and to change, to make a breakthrough when it comes to normal, already existing before military aid flowing to Ukraine on the other hand. Task number two is to solve domestic bureaucratic problems when it comes to public policy, namely under the Ministry of Defense, to organize the conscription, mobilization, rotation, demobilization for some of the soldiers in a way that will, you know, make it smoother than it looks now, because people who happen to be on the front line in February 2022 have no rotations and as of now have no clear perspective of when and how they are going to be rotated, but they are 24 months in the army already. This is another challenge, which is a domestic one. And the last but not least in this is that the unfavorable situation because of the lack of capacities at this very moment on the continental part of Ukraine, because we will speak about sea, and this is what Marina probably will focus on. But on the continental part of Ukraine, this kind of unfavorable situation on the battlefield, pushes on the side of Russia, which is very logical from Russian point of view, they are what Russia is going to do in 2024. Of course, they are planning to at least occupy the entire part of the Donetsk region. They are probably planning to organize another attacks somewhere, as I said, far away from already existing frontline areas, because why they wouldn't if they have actually the understanding that Ukraine lacks capacities to widespread the army in the equal quantities all around the border. But when it comes to diplomacy, we constantly hear proposals to go to negotiations instead of continuing a warfare. And Ukraine is not willing to negotiate at this very moment, neither from expert point of view, nor from political point of view and military point of view as well. For one very specific reasons, we don't see any constructive arguments that Russia is ready for constructive negotiations. And basically, this is Russian logic used in Donbas since 2014. Every time they are in a better position in the battlefield, they are starting pushing for negotiations in order to have a pause, in order to fix the situation, to start a new phase of military aggression from a better, let's say, position. Just and at this in 2024, I expect that Russia will be even doubling down on offering negotiations for Ukraine, just in order to drag Ukraine into some kind of a negotiation scheme. And the main idea of Russia in this regard is to diminish completely the military support, which is already questionable for Ukraine in 2024, and to make it not visible at all in 2025.
Great. Thank you so much, Maria. And I think, as you've outlined there, there hasn't been a shift in the land battlefront, significant shift since November 2022. So, Marina, could I bring you in now, because the developments in sea are, of course, very different. So could you take us through how the Black Sea arena balance of forces has transformed in that time and the recent developments we've seen? Just a question to the audience, is it easier in terms of hearing when, for me, compared to here? Because we could pass this around if that's better.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Okay. Yeah. Good evening. So let me complement what Maria started. She laid the ground of the discussion discussing the impasse on the ground on the land operation. And let me take you to the maritime domain, because you might have noticed that the situation there is in sharp contrast to what is happening. So in the land operation, we have basically the deadlock. We have the war of attrition. And the situation is clearly not to Ukraine's advantage. We've seen Russia gaining and maintaining the initiative. And in the maritime domain, in the Black Sea, the situation is fundamentally opposite. That's why I want to discuss it, that Ukraine now maintains the initiative. And it has been widely covered. You might have noticed that the list of the ships, warships, Russian warships from the Black Sea fleet, that Ukraine is targeting and sinking, constantly increasing. And so what's happening? Let me try to explain this Black Sea maritime domain. So Basically, why the Black Sea and why it's so important for Ukraine to withstand Russian aggression from the Black Sea? Because, I mean, you might have noticed that, of course, it's not only about the land. Russia, in the early days of the aggression, tried to carry out the amphibious operation next to Odessa. So if you imagine the Black Sea, so Russia occupies the Crimea since 2014. So Ukrainian coastline has been greatly reduced. It had, before 2014, the longest coastline in the Black Sea, not since 2014. So basically the Black Sea ports are a lifeline for Ukrainian economy. I'm trying to outline why Black Sea is so important for Ukraine. And let me focus on two major dimensions, which is military, of course, and the second one is economic dimension. So military dimension is that, fortunately, we didn't see Russia being able to carry out the landing operation in Odessa. But still, it managed to carry out the maritime blockade of the Ukrainian ports, Black Sea ports. So and it also established the land bridge connecting occupied Crimea, occupied Donbas. So it has a complete control over the Sea of Azov, which is a smaller adjacent body of water. That is also important because Ukraine had important economic the seaports there as well. So from military strategic point of view, Ukraine's objective at the moment is to continue to prevent Russia's ability to carry out this operation or military attack to Ukraine from the sea. This is the military objective. And the second one, the objective is, of course, to resume the work of its Black Sea ports and to resume the commercial, unimpeded commercial navigation in the Black Sea, which I, as described, tried to describe, the Ukrainian economy is very heavily dependent on. And on both tracks, we see quite significant successes. So what we've seen is that we call it the asymmetric warfare or asymmetric strikes that Ukraine has managed to carry out against Russian assets, both in Crimea but also the warships. So targeting the air defense, command and control, radars in Crimea. So those asymmetric strikes proved to be quite damaging. And what we've seen is that Russian Black Sea Fleet, which had a complete freedom of navigation in the whole body of water of the Black Sea, had to actually retreat from this part of the Black Sea, which is, you know, the northwestern part of the Black Sea, so the waters adjacent to the actually NATO waters, the Romania, Bulgaria, and Turkey and Ukraine. So it had to withdraw back to its own coast. And that means, because of course there is a risk of Ukraine targeting those naval assets. And according to recent estimates, we've seen around one third of the Russian Black Sea Fleet lost. And why? The question is, you might ask, it cannot reinforce its positions in the Black Sea. And there is one very important instrument here, which is in play. You might have heard about Montreux Convention and Turkey, which basically, when the war started 2 years ago, it invoked the Montreux Convention, saying that no warships any longer can enter the Black Sea, neither Russian, but neither nor Ukrainian or any other warships of NATO states. No external, non-littoral states. Why this is very important? Because that created the equilibrium to Ukraine's advantage. So Russia has other fleets, and it could reinforce its positions here by bringing the warships from other fleets. It cannot do any longer so, because Turkey, it has its own positions. It is a NATO member. So it's very, I mean, as I said, it's to Ukraine's advantage here. On the other hand, you might have registered the news that early this year, UK tried to donated two minesweepers to Ukraine, which would be a very significant contribution for those efforts to demine those waters next to the Ukrainian coast, because it's heavily mined. Black Sea now is the most heavily mined body of water in the world. So it would, as you can imagine, very much help Ukraine to restore this commercial navigation for the commercial vessels, you know, to have this access to the Black Sea fleet to go out to the Mediterranean from the Black Sea. So Turkey didn't allow those either. So basically saying that Montreux Convention applies to everybody, to belligerent nations and to also NATO. I won't say that there is much appetite for US or UK or French to bring their warships to the Black Sea, because there is a fear of escalation that Maria has described very well. But still, I mean, just for you to be aware that the situation here is like that. So, and on the second track, so I've described that Ukraine managed to carry out those strikes, and on the second track, restoring the commercial navigation. Again, for 1 year, we've had a Black Sea Grain Initiative functioning. That was mediated by UN and Turkey, and basically Russia allowing and not attacking the ships carrying the Ukrainian grain going out from the Bosphorus and Dardanelles. So having inspections, again, intrusive inspections, delaying those, but still it was working. In July last year, Russia withdrew from this, trying to basically suffocate those even those modest exports of Ukrainian grain. What Ukraine did, again, in very asymmetric fashion, it addressed this bottleneck, as it did in military, but it did it in economic. So in cooperation with its allies here in the Black Sea, Bulgaria, Romania, and Turkey, it was agreed that in the territorial waters of these states, there will be a new humanitarian corridor to carry out Ukrainian grain, but not only grain, and this is a significant thing, because Black Sea Grain Initiative allowed only for the grain to leave the Ukrainian ports, and you can imagine there are other commodities crucial for Ukrainian economy. So now this new corridor functions from early September or August last year, so several months, and we've seen that the exports almost being the same as, you know, at the pre-war level, almost reaching the pre-war level, which is again a huge success for a country that 2 years ago was almost on the threshold of being completely landlocked, of losing completely the access to the sea. So it has been significant. And I know that I don't have much time. Let me leave time for the Q&A. Just the last thing to say is that being aware of those successes, you know, resuming the commercial navigation, I forgot to mention, because it's in the territorial waters of Romania, Bulgaria, and Turkey, this corridor, you might again be aware that Russia would not attack those ships because it would be a direct attack on the NATO member, right? And so there is a threat. This is functioning at the moment. Fingers crossed that it continues to function like that. The last point, as I wanted to say, that as Maria mentioned, this is it has been a moderate success. But again, to completely liberate the Black Sea and to make this, let's say, success in the Black Sea complement the Ukraine's war efforts in the land operation, Ukraine doesn't have sufficient capabilities at the moment. So they have been promised, some of them have been committed but not delivered. And you can imagine that non-delivered capabilities make no difference, right? So they need to be delivered, they need to be in sufficient quantity and quality. And at the moment it looks as a patchy kaleidoscope of everything that the allies could supply to Ukraine. So yeah, I think we can leave it for the Q&A, but we see really the situation that Ukraine is, I mean, quite grim scenario, is on the verge, potentially on the verge of collapse if those capabilities are not delivered on time. I'll stop here.
So, Olga, let's bring you in now. And we've heard that the war is being fought in on land, in the air, and at sea. But of course, it's also being fought in the battle of ideas in the realm of propaganda. So could you take us through those kinds of techniques that Russia is using to fight the disinformation war, the propaganda war, and how they're affecting the balance of forces?
Sure. Hello, and thank you, Luke. Thank you, everyone, for coming, and thank you for inviting me to speak today. It's a real pleasure. Russia, as you rightly said, is conducting its war in various domains, and information domain is one of those. And in the information domain, we can, with a great deal of confidence, say that this is not just the war on Ukraine. So clearly the information domain and the cyber domain is the domain where Russia has been waging war also on other countries, on the West, on global democracies. And Russia's strategic goals 2 years into the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, they are not changed. So there are several goals. One of them is to undermine support for Ukraine internationally, using tools such as Ukraine fatigue and, you know, other tools that Russians use. Then internally destroy Ukraine's ability to resist, destroy Ukrainians' unity, destroy Ukrainians' resilience, undermine their trust in institutions, in the Ukrainian army. So that's the second strategic goal and the direction that Russians have been pouring a lot of resources into, especially in the last year compared to the first year of the full-scale invasion, when that unity and that resilience was really strong in the Ukrainian society. Then the third goal is to, in general, undermine global democracies and undermine the international legal-based order. And the fourth one is to create situational alliances that would help Russia politically to kind of launder its reputation, that would somehow legitimize the Russian regime, and also economically to help Russia overcome sanctions and keep its economy going. So Russians are using information, disinformation, propaganda, and cyber warfare to achieve all those four goals. And they are working with different audiences, as is already clear from this goal. So they are obviously targeting their internal audience. I will not stop there that much, because we know that the information environment in Russia is very strictly controlled by the Kremlin. There is very little space for dissent, so no independent media are left that are functioning inside Russia. The opposition has been physically eliminated, and the latest example is the killing of Alexei Navalny. So basically, inside Russia, there is no space for dissent, there is no space for any information that reflects the true situation on the ground. Then, in Ukraine, what Russians have been doing, in the first year of the invasion, it was really hard for them to achieve any significant impact with all their disinformation propaganda inside Ukraine because of a high degree of unity and resilience inside the Ukrainian society. So as you all seen, Ukrainians mobilized to participate in resistance in different levels. Some people took up arms, some people became volunteers and started to help the army, started to help the resistance effort. A lot of people also participated in so-called information resistance by joining cyber army and trying to undermine Russian institutions, Russian in the digital space, and trying to also to kind of break through that wall of disinformation propaganda inside Russia. So in the very first year of the invasion, it was very difficult for Russians to do that. But as the war has been going on, and also the kind of the trauma of Ukrainians have been exacerbating that unity and resilience, it is still there. But because of the long duration of war, because of the tiredness of people who suffer from daily missile attacks, who suffered in the last winter, autumn from frequent electricity cutoffs and heating cutoffs. So that resilience is not as strong as it used to be in the very first year of the invasion. And some Russian information operations actually have limited success in Ukraine. So if you even like do some monitoring on social media, you'll see that there is more criticism towards Ukrainian institutions, towards the president, towards the government, and that is partially a result of this Russian information operations that have some partial success in Ukraine. And then the third target is obviously the Western countries, Ukraine's allies, not all, maybe not all Western countries, but those countries that are Ukraine's allies, that are helping Ukraine. There are Russians let's say it is not as easy for them to reach those audiences as it was before the full-scale invasion because of the restrictions that have been imposed on the broadcasting of Russian Kremlin-controlled propaganda media such as RT and Sputnik that have been banned in the most of Western countries. But they are finding other ways to reach those audiences via social media mostly. Especially Telegram is the major vehicle now for Russian propaganda and disinformation inside Ukraine, but also in the West. TikTok, there have been high-profile campaigns in multiple languages revealed by BBC Verify, by Atlantic Council, the EFR Lab, on TikTok trying to discredit Ukrainian military leadership, namely former Commander-in-Chief General Zaluzhny. So this affects that these were Russian operations financed by Russia, conducted by Russia, targeting audiences in countries that are sympathetic to Ukraine. And then the fourth audience, and this is a very broad term because, of course, there are differences, but let's use this term in the global south. There, the access to Russian media such as RT and Sputnik have largely not been restricted, so they are allowed to operate. In some countries, they actually expanded their offices, like in South Africa, in Latin America. RT has been expanding, has been hiring new employees, and this Russian, they are not media, they are state-controlled vehicles of propaganda, but they are very often quoted as legitimate media outlets. They are, information from them is sourced by local mainstream media. The content is very often used by local media because it is sometimes cheaper to use RT or Aptly video than Reuters or AP or Associated or AFP content. And also Russians and Russian state-controlled propaganda outlets have been organizing trainings for journalists from many South, global South countries in an attempt, obviously, also to kind of sway them and just legitimize their operations. So some, very briefly, some other tactics that Russians have been using and increasingly in the last year. So they are increasingly using bloggers and influencers to get the message across. You've probably all heard and maybe even watched interview or, by Tucker Carlson with Putin. So that's just one example of how important figures, influencers, bloggers, former journalists, whoever, whatever we want to call them, how they are legitimizing Russian narratives. Then there are other examples with prominent people, very popular figures on social media and sometimes social media owners such as Elon Musk, very often amplifying Russian narratives. Some examples from Italy, just recently Russians brought several Italian actors that are quite popular in Italy, that are quite popular in countries of the former Soviet Union, such as Ornella Muti, for example, to occupy territories and to Russia proper. And from there, they create content to like millions of followers they have on Instagram or on other social media, basically trying to say, well, there is freedom of speech in Russia. We are allowed to say whatever we want. And look, Russia is developing, Russia is prospering, and all the, we need to lift sanctions and so on. So an increasing use of influencers and bloggers. Then, the use of AI has been improving. Initial Russian attempts to use artificial intelligence to create deepfakes were not particularly successful, but they are getting better with that. They are still not there yet, but if the first Russian videos of President Zelensky, manufactured videos, were really, it was very clear that they were fake, that they were not genuine. There were some recent attempts to deepfakes with General Zaluzhny that kind of were slightly more convincing, so they are getting better with the use of AI technology and new technology in general. So yeah, that's basically the kind of the general overview, and I'm very happy to answer your question. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you all so much. We've had a great holistic overview of all of the different dynamics of this conjuncture of 2024. I think, Olga, your point about this kind of renewed information confidence of the Russian regime is so important to understanding this picture. And so my colleague from the Syrian team at LSE today showed me a picture of these billboards that have been appearing in Lebanon, like vast billboards on the side of motorways with a picture of Vladimir Putin saying towards a multipolar world. So either from the Russian Federation or its outriders and supporters, but it's a massive information intervention. I guess, Mike, I know Maria wants to come in and you all now have an opportunity to respond to each other. So I guess my question to all of you is that this conjuncture of 2024 does also seem, and it's related to the Zelensky question too, a kind of return of domestic politics in Ukraine with a growing debate, growing plurality in domestic politics, and perhaps an end of the rally round the flag of dynamic towards Zelensky to some degree. I'd be really interested in hearing your thoughts on that and how that affected the battlefield dynamics. Maria.
Thank you. Actually, I wanted to say about one domestic instrument, which is Russia using in Russia and on Ukrainian temporary occupied territories and for international audience, but this is basically a question of politics, so I will actually combine how domestic political life or instruments are being used by Russia and Ukraine right now. In Ukraine, we still cannot, regardless of some political tensions between, for instance, President Zelensky and former Commander-in-Chief Zeluzhny, we can't still say that this is a full return, full-fledged return to normal political life. For a number of reasons, including the legislation, which is still in force, and there is no perspective it will be abandoned. I mean martial law, which actually restricts a lot of procedures which were usual for classical peaceful time political life, namely elections, which are directly banned, by presidential elections, which are directly banned by martial law legislation. Parliamentary elections in Ukraine are directly banned, and this is even more important, by Ukrainian constitution. And almost 30 years ago, when Ukrainian constitution was developed, there was a clear logic in that. In order to prevent any kind of of capture of power, actually, or moving of the country at some point to authoritarianism, the parliamentary election, because parliament actually has is a directly elected and this is a collective political body, in case there is an aggression against the country, in case there is a war, so or in any other case, so basically this is direct banned from Ukrainian constitution, which is the main law in the country, while presidential elections might be actually conducted during the martial law, but in case the legislation is changed. As of now, the legislation on martial law in Ukraine banning the presidential elections in Ukraine, and there is no readiness on the side of neither opposition nor the, of course, presidential power, presidential party to change this legislation for number of security, destabilization, and other risks which will come back to Ukraine and will be definitely used by, as Olga mentioned, by Russia, because if not from outside and if not on the battlefield, the very idea of undermining the Ukrainian state will easily be used by Russia, and Russia will double down on that in case Ukraine in 2024, let's imagine, changes the legislation on martial law and declares the presidential elections right now in these conditions. And that's why there is no return to normal, let's say, peaceful time mode of political life in Ukraine. And the fact that Ukrainian opposition, the parties which were in opposition before the 2022, are not actually behaving like an opposition exactly to, you know, to destabilize the situation from inside the country is a very big signal about that. But Russia is using an informational warfare, is actively using this instrument now, saying that after actually March or the latest May, when there was an inauguration of President Zelensky 5 years ago, the Ukrainian president will not be legitimate. This is one of the main messages which has been widespread, including by people who are not, let's say, working for Russia or not affiliated with any Russian instruments, any Russian projects, whatever. They are basically referring to the same which is Russia is saying. So if Ukraine does not re-elect the president right now, so regardless of whether it's prohibited or not prohibited by constitution and the martial law legislation, so this is not legitimate power in Ukraine. And the last point here, that right now, these days, even before the 15th of March, there is the so-called elections of, not president, but elections of Putin have already started. Not in Russia, but on temporary occupied territory, starting from February 25th, there is a voting process, so-called voting process, in parts of Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, Luhansk, occupied territories of Ukraine. How it looks like, there is even no electoral polling station. There is a person saying that she or he is representing an electoral commission, one or two security guys armed who are making a door-to-door campaign with the voting box. This is how the voting looks like. And even people, you can find this very easily on Google, there are already lots of photos about that. This is a duplication of what Russia did last year on those territories, and which is very important, Russia is using this to legitimize domestically and internationally the election of Putin exactly on Ukrainian occupied territories, and Russia is not going to make any step back voluntarily from already occupied territories. This is another reason why Ukraine is not going to negotiate unless Russia is not talking about withdrawal of forces from Ukrainian territories. And this is how Russia is organizing the policy on occupied territories in order to fix their presence there.
Marina, do you want to come in now?
Yeah, yes, just to add something on domestic situation is that, of course, there is war awareness. You can imagine the life of millions of people is disrupted, the daily life. You imagine school children who need to run to the bomb shelters several times per day, you know, interrupting their classes. So imagine how it is to live, you know. So we are based in here in the UK, but we travel often back home, you know. So we see that, and so it's a really you see the contours, and the tiredness from war or war fatigue, of course. On the other hand, I think, which should not be overlooked, there are so many waves that this resilience has been built within the last 2 years, but I would say even since 2014, because we are aware this is when the war started. So innovative waves to deal with. So it's not a failed nation. I mean, because many imagine that the country in war should look like a failed state. Nothing should function. But I mean, you would be surprised that everything is working. It's a functional. It's not a dysfunction. There's little trace of dysfunction in a daily life when you are there. So if Russia wanted to transform Ukraine into some sort of crippled state, it clearly failed to do so. And I mean, even the fact that Ukraine has received a status of the candidate for the EU membership, right? It has been a milestone for Ukraine. It has not been just a consolation prize that, guys, you fight and here you have it. No, it has been a testament that Ukraine has been carrying out the reforms. So in times of war, it was doing this. So, and I think this is very important to understand that it was possible. And so there is a resolve to carry on. There is, I mean, the idea of land for peace talks with Russia is hugely unpopular. So something which is sometimes taken for granted, I think, sometimes in the Western media. And I'm often approached with the question, informally, you know, on the margins of some conferences, but you are losing so much human lives. Why don't you want to stop the war? Because it's simply not in our control. I mean, as a nation, Ukraine is, and the West, by the way, it's the situation when Russia is resolved to carry on its offensive till its grand objective is fulfilled. And this objective is basically it's carrying out a war against Ukraine to subjugate Ukraine, but also it's a war against the West. And we should be aware about that, that it's, we might say here, I'm saying we might say that we are not at war with Russia, but Russia is clearly at war with us. I mean, with us, I'm talking about the collective West and Ukraine. So, and that means that, of course, I mean, that brings me again all the time to, you know, when I'm asked about the political prescriptions and the recipes what to do. And there has been so much of, you know, what we call self-deterrence, you know, trying not to escalate, when clearly we have an escalation ladder, when Russia is at the top of the escalation ladder and dictating the rules. And we are, I mean, again, we as the collective West, we are sending the helmets to Ukraine, thinking that, okay, probably to send the tanks or more offensive capabilities, other offensive, would be an escalation. So thanks God, 2 years after, we are at the stage when what was considered escalatory by us in the beginning is no longer. So we are at the stage when Ukraine is supplied by, you know, main battle tanks, by jets, but the long-range weapons. So this is very important. But again, as we, I think, we've sent that message, we've seen, I think, some messages that this will take, the support will continue as long as it takes. I think this is the formula, which on one hand is reassuring, on the other hand, ambiguous enough not to say that, you know, we are really committed to end this war. And when somebody says that, you know, Russia needs, Ukraine needs to win and Russia needs to lose, what exactly do we mean by that? I have a sense that, again, there is lots of ambiguity about what Russia's defeat is. And I'm personally very frustrated by the fact that sometimes, even in, at the expert discussions, there seem to be colleagues who are paralyzed by the fear of Russian collapse. Russia's collapse has been a much worse scenario in their imagination as Ukraine's collapse. So, you know, we have a revisionist power that openly challenges and confronts us, and we are concerned about its fate and survival and trying to defeat it, but not to defeat it to the extent that it cripples and collapses. And then there is no strategic tradition of thinking about Ukraine or, I don't know, Estonia, or, you know, there is a strategic tradition, I think, in the West of thinking what happens with the Russia-Soviet Union formally. So I think this is something that we need as experts, students, policymakers, decision makers need to tackle and deal with.
I think the first point you made is so important, that Ukraine's democratic vibrance and civic spirit is part of its successful resistance to Russian invasion. It's not an independent variable in all of this. I was told recently that that there have been 1,000 amendments to the conscription legislation part in the Ukrainian parliament, and that might be the most in the history of independent Ukraine for any piece of legislation.
It was
oversold to me in its description. But that's an example of a democratic vibrancy as part of Ukraine's resistance. So, Olga, please don't feel free to just respond to my question. You can respond to the
other. Well, actually, I think I want say too much, because I want to still leave some space for Q&A. I just wanted to add, you know, because you earlier mentioned that it's like maybe less rallying around the flag in the sense of like Zelensky, but I think it's much more than Zelensky, right? Like, so the unity of Ukrainians and their resistance is not a fight for the preservation of the current government or the president, but it's the preservation of Ukraine as an independent state. So Russia's challenge to Ukraine and Russia's challenge to the world is that it is basically denying the right to exist to a sovereign and independent state that it itself recognized, that it itself signed numerous bilateral and multilateral treaties with, and, you know, that actually even vowed to protect its sovereignty and territorial integrity when Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons under the Budapest Memorandum in 1994. So, I mean, the challenge Russia presents here is not just for Ukraine, it's a fundamental challenge, but the Ukrainians are on the front line. They are those that are most exposed to it, and what they're fighting now is their survival. Therefore, like all these half kind of compromises or suggestions to, you know, exchange the land or whatever else, make concessions, just do not appeal, because there is absolutely no trust in Russia and Russia's ability to maintain its international obligations, because its track record shows that it violated continuously all the previous treaties and agreements it signed. So I think the kind of what Ukrainians are trying to say for 2 years is it is not just our war, and look, we are suffering now, we are losing our best and brightest, we are losing an entire generation, but it's also in your interest to help us, to continue supporting us, not just like to help us for as long as it takes for what? For Ukraine to kind of stand and not collapse, it's not enough. So as long as it takes to for Ukraine to win and for the West to win. And what gives me some hope, I have no doubt that Ukrainians will continue resisting. I have doubts on how much longer you know, Ukraine's allies will support it. But what gives me some optimism recently is this scandalous, right, as many perceived remarks by President Macron about a possible involvement of other countries. I think this idea should be discussed. It should not be discounted. I know that many like find themselves opposed to it, but I think it really follows. It's a great like kind of response to the fact that it is always Russia that is escalating, that it is always Russia who is proactive, and just, you know, putting on the table an option which clearly very much irritated the Kremlin, because their reaction to it was like, oh, the nuclear war will start, and the usual nuclear intimidation. But I mean, just doing these steps that are proactive, showing the initiative, showing we are not afraid of, like, you know, escalating, just getting out of that escalation, kind of fear of escalation, that, because that strategy is clearly not working. We saw it's clearly not working. So not limiting the Western response, the response of the countries that support Ukraine, to just reacting, to just treading very carefully, but actually taking proactive steps and saying, well, everything is on the table, actually, because we have to win this war together with Ukraine. I think that's the way to go.
Wonderful. Well, thank you all so much. Let's take some speakers. Yep, from the floor. Yeah, I saw this gentleman first. Please raise your hand. I'll try to only keep a gender balance if I can, but that might prove.
Yes, hello. I have a question. You mentioned that the idea of the peace settlement in Ukraine is not particularly popular among people, but we are here trying to discuss the whole thing from the expert's point of view. So I would like to ask you the question about this peace settlement perspective, because the word impasse in the title of today's meeting is probably not just an incident, right? And as we reach this impasse point, maybe the idea of settlement is not that bad an idea. You mentioned that Putin will be the one, or Russia will be the one, that will take benefit of this settlement peace or ceasefire arrangement, implying that while Putin will take this time to replenish their resources, Ukraine will be, or the West collectively will be, doing nothing. If this is the implication or the hidden agenda behind this thinking, I think that this is kind of admittance that we are already losing it to Putin. And the other thing I would like to
thank, that's,
yeah,
that's
just one little thing about the peace settlement in Georgia. We see that Georgia still exists after the war in 2008 as a sovereign state, and that settlement there did not end up with
thank
the
you.
Liquidation.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's a hugely important point, the million-dollar question, really. So it was always going to be raised. So I do want to take some more. I want to take one at the back right here that I saw. Yeah, please. Can you jump up? I think you have a mic in your seat that you can turn on, hopefully. Oh, no, okay, you don't. Sorry, apologies.
Hello, thank you for coming in.
Closer to your mouth, please, we can't hear you.
Thank you for coming here today and talk. My question is regards the sanctions. Do you think that, so the EU has delivered like very harsh sanctions on Ukraine, on Russia, and these sanctions have yet, haven't been able to prevent Russia from waging its war. Do you think that there is a long-term impact that should be expected from these sanctions? Do you think that sanctions could hit in the latter part of 2024, maybe 2025? And do you think that it could maybe help military action? Should we just focus on how much support the West, how much military support the West is getting to Ukraine? Or could we also expect something from the sanctions to have a background effect that could prevent Russia, notably by debilitating its industrial capacity, prevent Russia from waging the war, and helping Ukraine unlock this impasse?
Thank you so much. Yes, right, let's go to this chap just there. Blue shirt, yeah, perfect.
Yeah, I'm just the Monday of incidents to Russia and then one of the biggest drone Ukraine.
Can you please just turn it on and
use the other mic. It's jumping in and out.
So regarding the sort of in the past 2 days, we've seen, first of all, an incursion by Russian dissidents into Russia and then also one of the biggest Ukrainian drone campaigns in Russia. And I wanted to ask about the sort of significance of this, especially regarding the this weekend's sham elections in Russia, and if that could have any sort of impact, especially regarding the information campaign and the sort of Russian propaganda around how good the or how well the war is going. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. And just no, don't do that. Don't do that. Pass it two doors down. Thank you.
Hello. My question is on the maritime theater. And so basically what I'm interested in is, I was wondering, you talked a lot about how Ukraine has been doing very well in the Black Sea. And I was just wondering, on the one hand, what sort of the like total material setup at the moment is, in your opinion, like, because I just saw there was another very big Russian warship that sunk. So I was wondering, on the one hand, what the sort of absolute material setup of both countries is in your view, who has like the material upper hand, and on the other hand, how that sort of can be built on, if there is any capacity for the Ukrainian maritime forces to receive aid from the West, and if so, how this can be done without going the sea route.
Thank you so much. And directly behind you, there will, and then we'll go to the front, and then we'll come back to the panel. Yep.
Hello, thank you. Olga, you gave a wonderful summary of Russia's global information warfare efforts. And I'd just like to ask one question around one of the really important points you made around influencers, social media influencers, or traditional media influencers. What kind of balance do you think we have of useful idiots versus agents of influence?
Great question. So let's, can we go to this side of the room, actually? Like, let's, on your way, we'll get 30 seconds here at max, so really quick. So sorry to rush you.
Yeah, so was there a chance for a negotiated peace early on in the conflict? So I'm thinking of the talks that took place in Istanbul between Russia and Ukraine. So was there a chance for a peace?
Brilliant, thank you. And there was one more in this side of the room, yeah.
My question is going to be pretty simple. It's, what do you think the impact of the US election is going to be for Ukraine?
No panel without that question.
It's always the concise questions that get you. And so that loads of wonderful questions. Thank you so much to our audience tonight. We have two connected questions on peace settlements. Mm-hmm. We have the question around how sanctions are impacting the global economy. We have the questions around the irregular Russian militia forces, really important, and their incursions, and what kind of impact that might have in Russia and on the balance of forces. And there also, I think, we have the war economy question. How is the setbacks for Russian forces in the Black Sea arena? What is Russia's material ability to replenish that capacity? Russia is pursuing military Keynesianism, that it can be called. It has a kind of command economy at the moment in terms of its war effort, and it plans to spend next year about $160 billion or thereabouts on the war. So it's still an asymmetric conflict, as you all rightly emphasized at the beginning. So I think that's a really crucial question. So thank you all. I don't know who wants to go first. Maria? Yeah, sure.
I can start with the wartime diplomacy round negotiations. This is basically, I have been dealing with it since 2014. When the negotiations were held around the Donbas issue. And the question is very simple here. So first and foremost, there will be no political deal, like Ukraine, for instance, had in 2014 and 2015 in the form of Minsk Accords. Why? Because actually Ukraine is not going to legitimize even in informal political declaration or whatever, the de facto occupation of the land. So basically, this is not possible, and it is not. It will be a political suicide for any kind of authorities, not only President Zelensky, because it's not from 2022, but this is clearly since 2014 that Ukrainians were not ready for any succession, any separatization, any occupation of Ukrainian land, and this is very crucial, and this is core of public opinion since 2014, and just became stronger in public mood after 2022. So there will be no political deal, but a lot of people here in UK and in the West in generally are talking and speculating somehow about the ceasefire. Ceasefire is a very technical issue. This is not just a readiness not to fight. This is a monitoring system who is going to monitor the ceasefire, what will happen to civilian population on occupied territories, what is the status of these territories, who is going to provide humanitarian aid to those people, and what is the perspective of these territories to be returned under the Ukraine control. As far as we are starting from the fact that Putin is legitimizing his power and authority over occupied territories, they will not leave these territories voluntarily at this point. And it means that even a ceasefire will be treated like just a temporary idea to drag Ukraine just into negotiations about ceasefire rather than keeping the ceasefire. Between 2014 and 2022, there was a special monitoring mission of OSCE on the ground, including unoccupied territories. They had daily reports, and in daily reports with which I started my coffee and my breakfast every day for those 8 years, there was stated that 90% of the violations of over 100 attempts to establish a ceasefire were coming from temporary occupied territories, namely from hybrid warfare which Russia waged at that time. So practically all the instruments, attempts to establish a ceasefire, attempts to organize the access to Red Cross and other humanitarian organizations to occupied territories, attempt to disengage forces from the front line, all failed. All were used and all failed. And there is no one evidence that when the front line is like 1,000 times longer than it was between 2014 and 2022, it will work out. And as Olga mentioned very clearly, completely in terms of diplomacy, completely support that logic of Russia is to undermine the Ukrainian state, to make it a failed state. And normal and constructive ceasefire, when there is no political deal but there is a ceasefire, is not actually fulfilling this goal. That's the main problem. And that is why there is clearly argued and well-grounded assumption on the side of expert community in Ukraine and beyond, for instance, in Poland or in Baltic states, that this kind will be of instrument will be just a precondition to another attack, that's all. So diplomacy is not, unfortunately, is not effective in the nearest future. And speaking about the Istanbul initiative, so basically there was no deal between Ukraine and Russia, and it was very specific kind of agreement because Ukraine signed a specific document about grain corridor with Turkey and UN, and Russia signed another declaration about allowing this corridor with Turkey and UN, and basically. By the way, this joint
idea was about Antalya talks, right, at early stage, so not Istanbul.
In spring,
Belarus. Early, so, yeah.
Different thing. He didn't sign it. There was no signature of Ukrainian, let's be very clear about that. There were talks. He didn't sign it, excuse me. So please show me the piece of news where it stated that Arakhamiya signed on behalf of Ukraine something in Turkey or in Istanbul in spring 2023. There were negotiations which continued almost 3 months, but they ended up with no deal at that time.
Let's...
Political will of the Ukrainians, based on the public opinion polls, which are still functionable and representative in Ukraine is that there is 5% of Ukrainians ready to sacrifice Ukrainian land in the form of occupation on the side of Russia in order to have peace. Because everyone in Ukraine on the ground, better than me, based in London right now, or better than anyone else, understand that this is not what Russia wants. They do not want 30% of Kherson region or 30% of Zaporizhia region. If they were satisfied with that, they can stop now, but they are not stopping.
Thank you for that. Marine, you can go in a different order. No, go, please.
I take to maybe on sanctions. So the problem with sanctions is not, so first of all, sanctions is not the only instrument. So it couldn't be the only thing that would like stop Russia from invading or waging the war. So it should be combined with other instruments. And the second thing with sanctions is that, well, Russia found a lot of ways how to overcome them, and there are a lot of countries that are helping Russia to circumvent the sanctions. And actually, we see now the signs and the signals that the U.S. has been sending to Turkey, for example, that there could be secondary sanctions imposed on them for like helping Russia to, you know, still profit and circumvent the sanctions. This actually had some effect and stopped some, you know, impact that Russia has been receiving via like redirecting some flows via Turkey and other countries. So it is, therefore, to answer your question on whether they could have an effect, yes, they could. There could be more sanctions imposed. There could be, the implementation could be monitored better, because now the problem is not that much with, you know, what has been decided, but like how they, that there is no implementation mechanism. Nobody's monitoring it. Nobody's ensuring that they are actually, are in place, because, yeah, there are a lot of ways how Russia can circumvent them. There are a lot of countries that are helping Russia to do that, and there is no accountability for that, basically. So it's not just the issue of, you know, the sanctions not being efficient. It's how they are implemented and how they are monitored, which is not efficient. And another thing that I wanted to add here, that like kind of the other instrument which is now being discussed also that could help, well, Ukraine, but also could potentially have an impact on Russia and its desire and willingness and ability to wage the war, is the transfer of Russian frozen assets. This is something that has been floated. Russians, we again see very irritated reaction, very alert, very kind of negative reaction from the Kremlin to that. And well, for me, this is a sign that this is, that could potentially be really effective, that could really work. So if they are that reacting that negatively, that emotionally, and, you know, threatening nuclear weapons, that means, well, this is something that we should be seriously considering, that it could seriously work. And the question about the ratio of agents of influence versus useful idiots, yeah, I don't have an answer, actually. And I think it's very difficult to draw the line. And yeah, well, definitely there are people who are on Russian payroll. It's very difficult to prove that, but there are some indirect, you know, evidence. Well, we know that Russia has been financing, for example, far right and far left political parties in many European countries. So there have been investigations about that. There have been some links proved. So we know that. There are speculations that Russia might have some compromising information on some high-ranking politicians in several crucial countries. Yeah, right. We are not sure. It's very difficult to prove, but I mean, it might be the case. So definitely, there is that element of money, of compromising information, but there is also an element of some people who genuinely or might not that much, you know, support the war what Russia is doing in Ukraine, but Russia's narratives about, you know, that they are waging war against Western imperialism, that Ukraine is just a proxy of the West, those narratives, they do resonate, especially in many countries of the global South. So many people might not support Russia, might not share, you know, the support the war and like the killing of civilians in Ukraine, but they might endorse some Russian arguments, and those are that would be useful idiots. I don't know who Pope is, actually. What do you think? Is he a useful idiot, or is he an agent of influence? I don't know.
Thank you so much. Marina, can you bring us to a conclusion? We've had a great set of answers to a lot of those questions, and I think you probably will do this anyway, but if you could talk about this material force question and irregular forces question to focus your comments, and then we would have covered the whole suite.
Okay, thank you very much. If I may, because the question, I will just add a question, chance of peace. And
there should be given
That's a cross-cutting theme,
yeah,
I think.
A cross-cutting theme. If there was a chance for peace early in the war, so I would agree with my colleagues here, there was no chance of peace. If we look and if we, at this Russia's strategic intent, the ones of us who follow this, who study that, and who know this closely, we know this is a total war for Russia, conducted with total means. So in December 21, just before this large-scale invasion started, or re-invasion, as we call it, started, Russia made an ultimatum to the West. You might remember this document, right? Where it said that NATO should go back to its 1997 borders. So it was not an ultimatum to Ukraine only, it was ultimatum to the West. So it was a sign at that time that it's basically a war not about Ukraine only. And I think it's about, it's clear that there is no chance for peace. I mean, I think it's very dramatic to understand, because we all are inclining to think that diplomacy should work at some point. But unfortunately, I think we need to brace the reality. We are living in a much more insecure world, and there is no return point at this moment. We just need to adapt to the new, much more threatening and risky environment, and that we are dealing with a revisionist power which are threatening our, I would say, even survival, not only national interest, but our survival. So I think, I mean, as a security expert, I'm dealing with security and defense. You know, this is my main topic. So I think we just need to be better prepared and to deal with as a matter of fact. So questions about the disparities, naval capabilities of Ukraine, what to do now? I mean, of course, there is a disparity, and it's unimaginable to think or unthinkable that Ukraine can, you know, bridge the gap between Russia and, in terms of manpower, in terms of the capabilities, everything, in terms of the, you know, how, I mean, tolerance for the losses. We know in Russian strategic tradition, there is absolutely high tolerance for the human losses, right? So they it's at the min grinder, you know, they can engage millions, you know, to this. And Ukraine, in Ukraine, of course, it's a completely different story. So what we do, again, is asymmetric warfare. And this modern warfare is, I mean, I think this is the case study for future, you know, researchers who will deal with this, how Ukraine, of course, with the Western assistance, alone it would not have a fighting chance. Of course, with all those modern capabilities, tries to actually expose those vulnerabilities that Russia has. Because we've seen, they had, I mean, it also exposed that Russia has a huge army, it was reforming it, but there were certain things that, for some reason, Russian army didn't manage to establish air superiority in the early days of the war. It saved Ukraine from a collapse, you know, command control. You know, so all there were some gaps. I mean, you can look at my colleagues at RUSI do amazing research on this, you know, so why the, you know, Russia didn't achieve its initial goals. So what I would say is Ukraine is able to expose those vulnerabilities and insulate itself sufficiently from Russian threat, and even as military experts say, to regain those losses, territorial losses, including Crimea. I think Crimea, I'm always asked, but Crimea is a special case. I mean, again, there is lots of abundance of, I mean, again, military expertise on the issue, but Crimea is not a special case, and there are capabilities that can allow Ukraine to gain Crimea back as well.